Our next case this morning, last case on the calendar, State v. Bardwell.
Good morning. Could I please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please?
You need some water?
There's some right there. Sorry.
You said 2 minutes, right?
Yes, please.
You seem to be suffering from the same condition I am.
Yeah.
To the need for water.
That's okay. Thanks, Your Honor. And may it please the court, Lila Silverstein on behalf of Therese Bardwell. Mr. Bardwell asked this court to reverse and remand for a new trial because the state's removal of African-American juror number 25 violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It is critical that courts enforce the right to equal protection under Batson because studies show that racial bias permeates our criminal justice system and that there is no arena of public life in which discrimination is more widespread than in the selection of juries. Now, in this case, the state makes an offensive and legally erroneous quota-based argument. They claim that because they allowed other African-American jurors to serve, there can't possibly be a problem. The Supreme Court has made clear that the Constitution forbids striking even a single prospective juror for a discriminatory purpose. That's a quote from Snyder versus Louisiana. And the reason for that rule is that the right to equal protection applies not just to the defendant, but to the juror herself. And jurors...
Doesn't the state make another argument, and that is that it offered racially neutral reasons for striking juror number 25?
Well, I guess I'll give two answers to that. First of all, the reasons given were not race neutral, so they fail at step two. But even if they were, they fail at step three.
Okay. One of the reasons was a perception by the prospector that prospective juror 25 had been sleeping or nodding off, dozing. I don't know what word you want to use. Would that be a race-neutral reason?
That would be a race-neutral reason. That reason fails at step three of the analysis, though. So providing...
Okay, let's work our way through these steps one at a time.
Absolutely.
I'm going to be simple-minded this morning. The other reason offered was the body language when answering the question about whether she knew anybody who'd been convicted of a crime. Is that a race-neutral reason?
That fails at step two because it's not clear and reasonably specific, which is also required at step two of Batson.
Why isn't it clear?
It's not reasonably specific. He said that he was removing her because her uncle was in prison and her body language demonstrated concern about that.
So would he have needed to articulate what he saw about the body language in order to...
Yes, for example, and it also has to be related to the case to be tried. That's the third aspect of step two. So, for instance, if he had said, this woman said that her uncle was in prison, and she was glaring at me when she said it, as if she blames all prosecutors for it. And then every time defense counsel was doing his voir dire, she was nodding and smiling. That would be clear and reasonably specific. But this vague demeanor-based challenge does not satisfy step two, Your Honor. And even if the reasons given satisfy step two, there's no question that they fail at step two, step three, rather, on this record. And the key cases to look at on step three are Miller L. versus Dretke and Snyder versus Louisiana. Under those cases, what happened here violated equal protection. The state claimed that it removed juror 25, again, because her uncle was in prison and her body language indicated concern. But when the court asked juror 25 if her uncle's situation would affect her, she said no. And the state did not ask a single follow-up question of juror 25. That failure to question is significant evidence of discriminatory intent under the case law. In Miller L., one of the reasons the prosecutor gave for striking both jurors at issue was that they each had a relative in prison. But the state didn't ask one of the jurors any questions at all about his relative situation and the effect it would have on him. And the state asked the other juror only a handful of questions about his relative situation.
So and the they both answer the same way, but one gives body language that troubles the asker and the other doesn't?
Pardon me?
Here, both prospective jurors respond with similar statements, but one gives a body language signal that concerns the attorney, the other does not.
Right, but what the court said in Miller L. is that the failure to question these jurors in any depth undermined the persuasiveness of the claimed concern. What the court also said.
Are you telling us then, as a matter of law, if the prosecutor does not ask follow-up questions, we cannot accept the reason given as being a truthful one?
I'm telling you that that is a significant factor in the analysis.
We're reviewing the trial court's finding, and we're using an abuse of discretion standard. So we have to ask ourselves, could the trial court have believed that the prosecutor offered truthfully offered racially neutral reasons? And you're seeming to suggest that if the prosecutor didn't ask follow-up questions, that alone would be making it impermissible for the trial court to believe the prosecutor.
I am saying that on appeal, the court in Miller L. made clear that the court must review the entirety of the voir dire record and review all relevant circumstances. That's the language from the case, to see if the reasons.
Okay, that is a relevant circumstance.
Correct.
But it is, are you telling us it is determinative? I'm suggesting maybe it's not determinative. It's one of a number of things we would look at.
Absolutely. But it's a strong indication, because what the court said is the state's failure to engage in any meaningful voir dire examination on a subject the state alleges it is concerned about is evidence suggesting that the explanation is a sham and a pretext for discrimination. So the court made clear that this failure to question is significant. Now, there are other parts of the analysis, but those also weigh in Mr. Bardwell's favor here. For instance, a comparative juror analysis. The state did not strike white juror number 5, even though she had a relative who had been accused of domestic violence, and unlike juror 25, she said some things that would have been concerning to most prosecutors. She was appalled by the number of panelists who did not seem to appreciate the presumption of innocence. And she said, hey, if I ever commit a crime, remind me not to do it in King County, because there wouldn't be enough jurors who could be impartial. Now, the fact that the state kept that white juror but removed juror 25 is additional evidence of an equal protection violation. And then, to top it all off, we have the untimely and uncorroborated allegation of sleeping. As the EJI report indicates, that type of allegation is a common tactic for removing African-American jurors. And this record demonstrates that that reason for removal is implausible. The record shows that the judge never saw this juror sleeping, that defense counsel never saw this juror sleeping, that this juror's head did not sag, and that she did not snore. And on top of all of that, the prosecutor never raised this claimed concern until after Mr. Bardwell made a Batson objection, even though sleeping would have constituted a basis for removing the juror for unfitness. So all of the totality of circumstances demonstrate an equal protection violation here. Thank you.
You'll have 2 minutes for that.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dennis McCurdy for the State of Washington, the respondent in this case. The defense makes a very serious allegation, the allegation being that the prosecutor engaged in an intentional violation of the Equal Protection Clause, colloquially a Batson challenge. Now, they claim that they're offended by the state's argument. I'll ignore the histrionics in this case. The way they're trying to prove their challenge is by a syllogism. The prosecutor was white. They used a peremptory challenge on juror number 25. Juror number 25 is black. The stated reasons by the prosecutor are not fully stated in the record, or they're weak. And therefore, you have a necessary conclusion that there was purposeful discrimination in the bumping of juror number 25.
Haven't you left out the comparison of the juror who was white, who had known someone who had been convicted of a crime, and the African-American juror who knew someone was convicted of the crime and the...
I'm sorry, what was the second one?
The African-American who knew someone had been convicted of a crime as well. And the white juror gives answers which I think I'd have to agree with counsel would normally concern a prosecutor. No similar questions or answers elicited from the other juror who was struck. So that they're arguing that if we look and see if two people similarly situated were treated the same, the answer is no, and the only reason that we can identify is the color of that person's skin.
Well,
I think that's part of their argument.
It is. And one of the things that I admit in my brief, all of those things are factors. But I would take exception to one thing where you're talking about the juror that said something about, I believe in the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and gosh, the state would bump a juror that doesn't? That's somewhat ludicrous.
I said a little more than that. I wouldn't want to be tried in King County, which is right. Where this trial took place, I think.
Because that juror believes that other jurors don't believe in that standard. Why does that mean the prosecution would bump that person? Because we believe in that standard as well. It is the standard in every single case. So the fact that one juror says, I'm concerned that these other jurors don't believe in that standard, that's not a reason to bump a juror. But I think what's important to note here, all of these things are factors, and we look at that on the totality of the record. And what the defense wants to bury and call offensive, they don't even mention it except in a footnote in their entire opening brief, there was two other African-Americans that the prosecutor accepted onto the jury two deliberations with challenges left. So how can you say you want to just have a presumption based on, for example, didn't ask additional questions? Well, you can pick on anything you want, but if you go back to, like, Sancali, Judge Wiggins in his decision starts talking about, well, if you ask too many questions of a juror, that can be evidence of discrimination. All of those things can be evidence of discrimination. I'd like to get counsel to come back up here and talk about how much time in a voir dire does a prosecutor have to talk to each individual juror. In this case, it would be less than 2 minutes per juror. It is the system that we have now. It's not perfect. It's not a good system. But the burden's on the defense to prove intentional, purposeful discrimination. And in this case, for example, let me give a rhetorical
is the problem then that we've adopted what, at least when I was practicing, we sometimes called the Phil Donahue or Strzok method, and we should go back to the old method of questioning each juror one at a time?
Well, Your Honor, I'm old enough to have been in that situation as well. And I think Judge Sullivan, I think, was the last judge in King County that still used that system. The reason for changing? Speed. In my opinion, was more than anything else.
Well, prevent lawyers from trying their cases when all we're trying to decide is if we can get fair people.
Well, I think what you see now is attorneys trying. I think you can do it now, much easier. Try your case in this method, which, variously been called the Phil Donahue method, and now nobody knows who Phil Donahue is. It's the Oprah method, but I think you can try your case much more easily now than you could going one by one in the old system.
Is there any requirement that the prosecutor ask follow-up questions?
No. Again, it is a factor. I'm not disputing it's a factor. But again, when you've got less than 2 minutes per juror, you can't ask all the jurors all these questions. And again, if we'd asked her a bunch of questions, go back to Sincali. The juror in that case had their best friend murdered, shot and killed, 2 weeks prior to jury selection. And she said in some of her opening sentences, I'm having a tough time with this. And yet one of the accusations against the state was, well, you asked her too many questions. Well, of course we did, because she was having a difficult time. We wanted to see if she could even survive the trial. So my point being, they're all factors, but they don't work in this case because of the other factors that the defense wants to ignore, and they call offensive. And I'd like to go back to a rhetorical hypothetical, because I'm not asking the question of your honors, but let's say you had a job opening and you had five finalists, applicants. Two of them are African-American. The job is given to an African-American. He said who the boss or whoever decides says is qualified. The other African-American files a lawsuit and says, no, I'm qualified. This is discrimination. How on earth can that, can you reach that presumption? That's the exact situation you have here. The prosecutor could have,
could have had three black jurors on this jury. There was more than one position being filled.
Absolutely.
So it's really not a very perfect analogy because there's only one job in your situation, so it's A or B. Here we don't have an A or B choice.
But the point is the defense wants you to draw a presumption. And in some cases, that presumption is valid. It's not valid in this case.
Well, do you think that the defense counsel in this case had enough to get us to step two of the Batson analysis?
It's clear that they did not. The defense counsel, first, they gave two reasons. First, they said, well, my client's black, that juror is black. Well, we know that's not sufficient. And the court says that's not sufficient. You got to actually provide a reason. And then the second thing, so after that, then the counsel says, well, I don't see any reason why she wouldn't be a good juror. Well, that's not a reason either. These are peremptory challenges. The U.S. Supreme Court in Batson recognized and is codified in state law that a peremptory challenge is a challenge for which no reason needs to be given. When you're conducting voir dire,
you have need to put an asterisk after that. No reason needs to be given so long as it's not a prohibited reason.
Exactly. And a prima facie case is made. When you're conducting voir dire, you may have, juror number 14 in line. You may think, well, that person's perfectly good, but I actually like juror number 15 better. That's perfectly valid to bump number 14. In order to get into Batson, you've got to make that prima facie showing. Now, I readily admit the case law is we don't have to get there.
14's white, 14's black and 15's white. We might get into Batson if you say you like that juror better, and that's the reason.
No, the reason has to be because of race.
That's what I just said. We had two.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
We don't know what's going on in your head. So if there are two jurors there, there's a black one, and the next five are white, and you know the defendant's only got two peremptories left. Would that be enough facts to trigger step two of Batson?
You have, in every single case, the facts are going to be different, and you may, in fact, have a presumption.
I just described be enough to get you to step two?
If that is your only, can I add one fact? Because I think if that's your only African American, I think we use 14.
I have the next five white.
Right.
And the defendant only has two peremptories. So if this one's gone, there's not going to be any black juror coming in to replace it.
And that's my point. There's not going to be. If the prosecutor's already accepted four other African Americans, then no, it's not a valid factor. If there is none, one of the issues with Sincali is it happened to be the only African American. In that situation, yeah, I think that would meet that prima facie showing. If I'm a trial judge, that's the way I rule. But, they're hypotheticals and we have to have a presumption, and those presumptions might work in some case. They simply don't work here. Unless there's any other questions, I'd ask this court to affirm.
Thank you, Judge.
The state properly conceded in its briefing that the question of whether there was a prima facie showing is moot, but I will note that there was more than enough for a prima facie showing. Defense counsel raised a Batson challenge, pointed out that the juror was a member of a protected class, pointed out that there was nothing she said or any relevant circumstances indicating a reason for her removal, and perhaps most importantly, pointed out what we talked about earlier, which is that the state never questioned her about her uncle and whether that mattered. And the state led the trial court astray by telling the trial court that that was irrelevant when, in fact, it is highly relevant under the case law. And to imply that the state wouldn't have had enough time to ask her questions doesn't make sense. The state did, for instance, ask juror 20 several follow-up questions after juror number 20 said that he or she had a bad experience getting pulled over by the police.
Is there any way to solve this short of just getting rid of peremptories?
Well, Your Honor, there have been several proposals. One of them was getting rid of peremptories in that was proposed by Justice Marshall a long time ago, and it was also proposed by Justice Gonzalez in St. Cali. Justice Wiggins proposed a rule in the lead opinion in St. Cali, and we have asked this court to adopt that proposed rule. That would help, and we should adopt a more protective rule in Washington because this is a persistent problem.
Isn't that something we don't have the capacity to do here?
I think you do have the authority to do that. Justice Wiggins cited both the 14th Amendment and Article 1, Section 21 as providing authority for the court to craft a solution to this persistent problem. But the first solution is simply to enforce Batson. And under the analysis required by Batson, Miller-El, and Snyder, this court should reverse under Batson itself.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess.
All rise. Court is in recess.